Welcome to Global Talk, an international affairs podcast from The National. I'm Justin Vella. On the line is Timur Khan, the newspaper's New York correspondent, who has written an article about the difficulties the anti-ISIL coalition faced in rescuing Jordanian pilot Mawaf al-Kasasbeh, who was later burned alive by the militants. What kind of attempts were made to rescue al-Kasasbeh after his plane went down?
Well, there's no kind of definitive narrative that's, you know, come out about those attempts. I mean, U.S. officials say that as soon as they heard that a Jordanian plane had gone down, it's unclear if it was shot down or mechanical issues, failures, that they dispatched a rescue team to get him. They also say that there was essentially no chance for him to be rescued. As soon as he came down, you know, he landed in a river. It was very close to ISIL forces. They spotted his parachute, and he was captured within minutes. There's been other conflicting reports saying that he was, you know, in that lake rather. I think it's Lake Assad, and he was there for, you know, an hour at least. But there wasn't enough time for the rescue search and rescue units to get to him. And, you know, part of that, I mean, regardless of how long it took for him to be captured, the U.S. Search and rescue forces were reportedly based in Kuwait, about 1,300 kilometers away. And so if they were, you know, usually the aircraft that's used there are helicopters, and that would be an hour's long flight from Kuwait to Raqqa or that area.
Right. So essentially they were pretty much just too far away.
Yes.
Which is surprising, given that the U.S. has such advanced military capabilities, as do some of its allies in the anti-ISIL coalition. Why do you think that these helicopters that could have potentially rescued the pilot were based in Kuwait? And what were some of the other challenges in rescuing him?
Well, and I just also wanted to say that the commander of coalition forces is a U.S. general, three-star general based in Baghdad. And so regardless of the nationality of the pilot that went down, it would likely have been U.S. search and rescue, teams that would have gone after him. But these assets were based in Kuwait essentially because it's a long time, you know, U.S. forces have been based there for a long time. There's a big base, all of the maintenance staff, pilots, search and rescue teams, they're on 24-hour standbys. And so there's a lot of people that rotate in and out. And so there's a long, you know, what military officials call a tail for the search and rescue operations. There's a big, you know, staff involved beyond the combat units that go out. And so I think it was kind of, you know, inertia, so to speak, that kept the U.S. forces based there rather than closer to the theater of operations. And I think the shoot down of the downing of the pilot was a big kind of wake up call for the coalition to have a better strategy in place for search and rescue.
Right. I know that you talked to some former special forces soldiers for this article. What did they say made the prospect of rescuing the pilot so challenging?
Well, I talked to two former special operators who were both had experience in search and rescue. The distance and the time that it would take for the units to get to reach where the pilot potentially was obviously one of the first things. But Syria also presents a particularly difficult environment within which to carry out an operation like this. I mean, you know, much more than in Iraq, where there's hostile and friendly forces as well as U.S. trainers on the ground, and even more than in Afghanistan, where there's also a mix of, I mean, there's NATO forces as well as friendly Afghan forces there. You know, Syria is totally hostile. And you have the regime and its air defenses. And then you also have the, you know, ISIL-controlled territory, which is populated. And it was daytime as well. So getting close to a populated area, there are probably lots of ISIL fighters out in the desert as well. It would be there's not a lot of cover out there. And so, for a number of factors, it would have been, you know, the kind of as difficult as it gets in terms of a search and rescue operation, according to these guys who I spoke with.
One of the main challenges, it seems, in both rescuing the Jordanian pilot and also the U.S. and British hostages, or excuse me, the U.S. and European hostages that have been captured by ISIL, is a lack of intelligence on the ground. It seems that Syria has become a virtual black hole when it comes to intelligence gathering. Is that true?
Yeah, they talked about that as well. I mean, the coalition U.S. has, you know, in terms of signals intelligence, which is intercepting communications by the militants. I mean, there's as sophisticated as it gets capabilities there by the, you know, U.S. intelligence, and also geospatial intelligence, as they call it, which is like imagery from satellites and drones. That's pretty, you know, robust as well. And so those are important, but the human intelligence, which is, you know, much more difficult, slower to evolve, takes more time to develop. That is missing. And so when you know, there was an attempt, I believe in July over the summer, by U.S. Special Forces to rescue James Foley and Stephen Sotloff, the two U.S. journalists who were held hostage by ISIS. You know, the team that went in, the search and rescue team, the Special Forces team that went in, kind of did a perfect job in getting to the location, fighting ISIL forces, you know, infiltrating the building, but the guys weren't there, and they had reportedly been moved days earlier, and that kind of reflects, you know, what happens when you're only relying on one or two streams of intelligence, and you know, that are not human intelligence, kind of adds to the level of difficulty and the, you know, I mean, so far inability of any special forces to rescue anybody held by ISIS.
To read more of Tamer's stories, visit thenational.ae/world and follow us on Twitter @thenationalrome.